thank you to all our loyal donors for supporting the CIUT Love Your Radio donation drive, especially during such a difficult time. There's still time to help. Go to CIUT.fm and click the donation button, or send a check to 89.5 Tower Road, Toronto, Ontario, M5S0A2. Right here, right now, every day. CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the producers and or the persons appearing on the program, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of CIUT FM.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host, and I'm very happy that at long last I'm able to again to record interviews with important individuals that got important things to tell us. Our guest is Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
It's good to see you, Stephen. There's so many things, but we'll try to focus, first of all, on your most recent essay, in which you talk about North Korea and its alienation from the process with it was involved with in the United States. It had a kind of dramatic moment, for reasons unknown to me. The government of North Korea, the People's Republic of Government, blew up a building. What was that all about, and why was that necessary?
Yeah, they blew up a building which was known as the Inter-Korean Liaison Office, which was established after the leaders of the two Koreas met in April of 2018 and decided that they would work toward a peace on the Korean Peninsula. And the way this has been, or the reasons that North Korea's, or for North Korea blowing up the liaison office, have been presented in the Western press as another example of North Korean belligerence and irrationality. But that conceals the real story, and the real story, the essence of the real story, is that the essentially saying, we arrived at an agreement about 2 years ago, and you, South Korea, haven't lived up to your part of the agreement, so we see that the agreement is no longer in effect and is void, and this is the way in which we're going to signal that we're essentially rejecting the fact that you've played us. Mm-hmm. And I can go into more detail about why it is that they believe they've been played or deceived.
Yeah. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and Stephen has written a book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, the story of Korea's struggle for freedom, Baraka Books. I think, by the way, for everybody to understand, this is a good place to begin is with that book. This story of the problem of on the Korean Peninsula, here we are, it's 2020. To my knowledge, U.S. troops arrived there at the end of World War II. There were peace agreements, United Nations were formed, but the United States never went home. How come?
It never went home because the intention of the United States was to establish its primacy throughout the world. And it had an agreement with the Soviet Union, its ally during the Second World War, that it would divide the Korean Peninsula. At least this was the agreement, that it would be divided for the purpose of accepting the Japanese surrender. The Japanese had colonized Korea. And it would be divided as a way of marking two occupation zones. The United States would occupy the south of the country and the Soviet Union the north. But the agreement stipulated that both armies would leave after a period of 5 years, at which point the Koreans would assume responsibility for their own affairs. As it turned out, The United States was somewhat late in arriving in South Korea to take up their occupation. And by the time they had arrived, the Koreans had already proclaimed a republic in Korea and said, we've disarmed the Japanese, we've taken back control of our country, and this is our country now. There's no need for you to arrive here and force an occupation. The U.S. forces simply ignored the Koreans' wishes and occupied the country, imposed a military dictatorship, and then eventually, not too long after, installed kind of a puppet ruler who was an anti-communist, who'd spent 30 years in the United States. And it was never really the U.S. intention to leave Korea. The Soviets left.
That's a very important issue. I mean, you probably know, often think about this. You know, anybody grew up in North America, we had a little basic patter about the threat of communism. And the story always was the communists take over a country, they never leave. But it turned out that isn't very accurate, is it?
No, it's not. And the Soviets did leave in 1949, essentially when the Korean people asked both armies to leave, and the Soviets left. The Americans then became somewhat embarrassed by the fact that they were still occupying the country. And so they made a show of quitting the Korean Peninsula. So most of the combat troops left, but they left behind advisors and secret protocols, which essentially placed control of the South Korean military in U.S. hands. South Korean military and the South Korean police were secretly run by the United States. And this has persisted. So until today, the United States, as you mentioned, still has a presence in South Korea, a very substantial one. But the United States, even more substantially, has control over something called the name just escaped me. But essentially, they have control of both U.S. and South Korean forces on the Korean Peninsula. And there's been a discussion going on about the point at which control over South Korean forces would transfer to the South Korean government, because the South Korean government does not have control over its own military. That military is under the control of a U.S. general. And these talks have been going on for quite some time, with the South Koreans insisting that the United States cede control of South Korean forces. And just recently, in the South Korean newspaper, the Hankyore, there was a discussion on part of the current U.S. general who leads the combined forces, talking about, well, yeah, you know, eventually we're on the road, we'll eventually hand over control of your forces to you, but you know, this is an ongoing process. It's not clear that the United States has any genuine, sincere intention to cede control of South Korean forces.
There's a pattern about the U.S. behavior that you've often noted in your writing on this, and again, I'll remind people that you have a very good book telling the history, published by Baraka. What we have, as we do today, a president who seems to get all the attention. He just sucks up all the space, and people attribute American policy to Donald Trump. But Bill Clinton and the Bushes all went through a kind of Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, Bush Jr., they always seem to have a similar kind of exercise when they dealt with the government of North Korea. That is, talks would be initiated, there'd be a plan. And in the case of Bill Clinton, I believe it was going to be a plan to provide energy or something. I'll ask you to elaborate. But really, what we is there's a continuity in American policy, no matter who, whether it's the current character who gets far too much attention, or allegedly the most rational person on earth, Obama. Could you talk about that? Why is that?
I was having exactly that thought about 2 hours ago, thinking, you know, too much is made of the fact that Trump seems to be an aberration, and he's not as much of an aberration as I'd like to believe. That a lot of Trump government foreign policy, even domestic policy, to a large extent, is simply a continuation of policies of other administrations. So you were alluding to the Clinton administration, and this is an interesting case because there's a continuity between what happened under the Clinton administration and what's happened today. With the dissolution of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, the U.S. Air Force announced that it was going to retarget its strategic missiles, which had been targeted on the old Soviet Union, or some of them would be targeted now on North Korea. And when the North Koreans heard that, they said, well, if that's the case, we're withdrawing from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we're going to develop our own nuclear weapons as the only means of safeguarding ourselves against this nuclear threat. So almost immediately, the Clinton administration intervened and said, well, okay, if you don't do that, what we'll do is, and you close your plutonium reactor from which you get the fuel to develop your nuclear weapons, we'll replace that closed plutonium reactor with two proliferation light or proliferation safe light water reactors. And so a deal was done. Pyongyang shut down its plutonium reactor, didn't withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And then the United States deliberately carried on the building of those reactors. And the reason it did so was because in the early 1990s, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc, the CIA decided that North Korea's demise was imminent. And North Korea did go through these immense difficulties as a result of the collapse of its trading partners. And the reasoning of the Clinton administration is, why invest in the development of these reactors when government's going to collapse anyway, and North Korea will be absorbed into our ally, our junior partner, South Korea. Well, when the CIA's prediction failed to pan out, that's when the Bush administration decided to effectively declare war on North Korea by including it under this axis of evil. But North Korea was being played here. I mean, what the United States had done was suggested that it was going to provide some assistance with the expectation that eventually the country would collapse. So today, this has happened as well. And on New Year's, the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, gave his usual New Year's speech. And in his New Year's speech, he talked about the negotiations with the United States. He said he was frustrated. And he was frustrated because first of all, North Korea is very interested in arriving at some kind of modus vivendi or peace with the United States because it requires peace and détente in order to develop economically. It's impossible for North Korea to develop economically while the United States has effectively organized an almost complete blockade of the country. So the North Koreans, more than anyone, would love to establish peace and détente with the United States. And they bend over backwards to do so. But he said, so in pursuit of that, what we did was we stopped our missile testing, we stopped our nuclear testing, we closed our nuclear site, our nuclear test site, but the United States has done nothing in return. Instead, it's done the complete opposite of what you would expect it to do if it was actually interested in peace and arriving at some kind of mutually agreeable détente or arrangement. So it's continued to conduct joint military drills with South Korea, he said, despite the fact that Donald Trump had promised to suspend the exercises. And these military drills are regarded as highly provocative by North Korea because they're built around a plan, which is essentially one of invading North Korea and overthrowing the government. So they say every time you undertake one of those exercises, you're essentially practicing the invasion of North Korea. Moreover, we don't know when, I mean, every time you undertake one of those exercises, whether it's an exercise or whether it's the prelude to an actual invasion. And secondly, they said the United States continues to escalate its military threat against us by sending to South Korea state-of-the-art weaponry that far outclasses anything we have. And at the same time, the United States has imposed more and more and more sanctions upon us, tranche after tranche after tranche, in an effort to bring about our collapse. So he said, we've been played. Just like the Clinton administration played us. His intention is, Kim Jong-un, the intention of the United States is to force collapse, pretend that they're engaged in negotiations and discussion, that they're interested in peace. And in fact, they're simply interested in us stopping the development of our nuclear weapons so that they can continue their so-called maximal pressure campaign. And the maximal pressure campaign is, you know, tantamount to a knee on the neck. I mean, the intention is to suffer.
The knee on the neck has become a popular metaphor.
Yes.
It works. By the way, apropos of that, I mean, it is true that the countries around the world that have experienced colonialism and are now experiencing neocolonialism, they would like black Americans to know that what is happening to them has also been happening in those countries, Vietnam, Libya, Iraq, Iran. At the moment, they're trying to cut off the ability of Iran to breathe, and Syria. And, you know, you really, in focusing on North Korea in some ways is the elder brother in all this, because, boy, they have had it rough. The war that America waged there, my memory serves, I think it was one of the top American commanders boasted. He said, we've run out of things to blow up.
Mm-hmm.
Flatten. And then when they enter into talks, the talks seem to go up and around and end up with the idea that North Korea should capitulate, which they refuse to do. I want to remind everyone, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans. I don't know if I can put this up. This might end up being shown somewhere, but this is Stephen's book, Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, Stephen Gowans, Baraka Books. By the way, Stephen, you're at, is it Stephen Gowans Blogspot? Which is your favorite identifying to reach you, to read your columns?
Gowans at WordPress.com, I believe.
I'm glad we clarified that. Well, behind us, as you point out in most of your writing, the biggest problem that the countries of the West, led by the United States, I shouldn't say the biggest problem, the problem is that they really reject or oppose the existence of socialist governments.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate?
Absolutely.
Syria, North Korea, governments that insist on their own development, like the Islamic Republic, who do not accept hegemony or IMF guidance. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, they're opposed to any country that does not automatically accept and bless an open door for the United States to invest to send products, to essentially turn another country into an economic extension of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, so it's opposed to socialist governments, because socialist governments say that we're, you know, we're organizing our economy on behalf of the people within this economy, not organizing on behalf of the profit imperatives of U.S. investors. And nationalist countries say that as well. Yeah. And so the United States has always been opposed to communist governments, socialist governments, and economically nationalist governments, because they limit the profit-making opportunities of U.S. corporations.
And isn't that also the founding document, and I guess I should bring in the opinion of the latest comments of President Putin of Russia. They had a meeting of the victors in World War II, those who crushed Nazism, and they wanted to create a world order where they could nations could live together peacefully. Mm-hmm. In entering into the United Nations and dotting the I's, crossing the T, and signing at the bottom, the United States didn't say that you couldn't be socialist. But that seems to be what's gnawing at the entrails of the UN at the moment. What are your thoughts about that? Putin is saying we need to go back and discuss that, because you can't say, I don't like your economic system, I'm going to spend my... use my army, navy, and the economy to crush you. According to UN, that really isn't proper.
No, it isn't. And all relationships among countries should be based on mutual benefit. The trade and the economic interaction among the countries should be based on mutual benefit and voluntarily entered into. But as one U.S. historian once said, the United States' definition of free trade is, we need, you give, or we need, you, we take. But anyway, trade should be based on what's good for you and what's good for me. Let's find something that's mutually agreeable that benefits both countries, likewise politically. But that's not the U.S. view. And the U.S. uses its economic weight, its political weight, its military weight, and diplomatic weight to simply extort benefits from weaker countries. Mm-hmm. And there are a few countries that are unwilling to put up with that kind of extortion. And you mentioned many of them, mm-hmm. China to Iran to Syria, North Korea, Cuba, mm-hmm. Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. We seem to be in a kind of a crisis now with not only North Korea. I mean, North Korea is always what they call a flashpoint, but the decision of the U.S. to reassert its hegemony, Western Europe's hegemony, NATO. It's hitting pretty heavy headwinds, and the triumphalism of say 10, 15 years ago is not so triumphant. Take an example. There's been a condemnation by Washington and London and Ottawa, others, of recent decision of Chinese government to assert the necessity of providing its security for Hong Kong as part of China, given the riots and the involvement of Western NGOs and others in Hong Kong. So they objected, and the U.S. makes a big noise, and they talk about the world, the international community. But there was a vote at the UN Human Rights, I think it is, committee, something like 48 countries wrote a letter together, and the Cubans read it. That's more countries than were supporting the U.S. and U.K. So something's going on here. What are you seeing a multilateral return, maybe, to multilateralism? And problems for the old colonial system?
I mean, it's interesting because the United States, decided that it would establish a new kind of relationship with China, which China accepted, because China recognized that this new relationship would allow China to develop and lift itself out of poverty. One of the few former colonial or colonized countries or semi-colonized countries that's been able to do that. And now that it's become the second largest economy in the world and is challenging the United States for supremacy in all kinds of strategic economic sectors, the United States has realized that while it benefited from its relationship with China, it's now at risk of losing its primacy in the world and has been reacting accordingly. And if you read, for example, the Wall Street Journal, it's quite clear what the U.S. problem is. The U.S. problem has everything to do with economics and everything to do with the fact that the Chinese economic model is now a threat to the U.S. model of free enterprise and is a threat to U.S. free enterprises as well. I mean, it's, they blanch at the idea that the Chinese are going to dominate high tech, for example, or supercomputers, or 5G. And this is largely a commercial and economic war, but in order to justify it, they have to invoke some other kind of banner under which to wage their war. And so this becomes, you know, these contrived human rights complaints about Hong Kong. And you can go on to the list of all the countries that the West and the United States have tried to exacerbate secessionist tendencies in. I mean, there's Hong Kong and Taiwan and Tibet and, you know, the Western China where we have the Turkmenic population, the Uyghurs. And they'll do their best, that is the United States and NGOs and the CIA and all the other Western intelligence agencies, to try and foment dissension and secessionism within those areas. And then to attribute their hostility to China to these alleged human rights violations, when in fact the hostility is driven entirely by economic competition. Mm-hmm. And it's not only Huawei that's become the target. There are other Chinese companies, and they become the target under this pretext that you have to save, or that these country or companies rather Chinese. These companies are challenging U.S. national security or Canadian U.S. or national security and so on.
Mm-hmm. I think we're speaking to Stephen Gowans. And by the way, this is the Tater Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. Stephen, this is big stuff. Here we are, little Canada, or sometimes we punch above our weight, according to Stephen Harper. Suddenly getting a big part in a drama, and I find it quite striking. When the story first broke about the Canadians apprehending Meng Wanzhou at the Vancouver airport, and it was very quickly known that the Prime Minister was aware that this was going to happen. Huawei is a Canadian company in the sense that it does a lot of business, hundreds, I don't know, maybe thousands of employees, trains personnel. It also invests in Canadian education, really very beneficial to Canada. But this step was taken with the cooperating with the FBI. And China was most unhappy, of course. And the first 2 days, I would say, I was watching all the media. They said there were people who would appear on TV and say, are we a vassal of the U.S.? I mean, it seems like we're being like a vassal. But I haven't seen the vassal guys appear since then. I assume you might have been one that might have agreed with him, but all this time, now that story has changed, Do we accept to be bullied by China? Meng Wanzhou is a businesswoman, not wanted in Canada for anything. Her company has highly benefited Canadians. And we apprehended her. So I guess the question is, since we did that on behalf of the United States, isn't the United States the bully in this thing?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's the bully, and we're the saps. And it's hardly surprising, though, that Canada should behave in this way. Although, yeah, I say hardly surprising. There are instances in which Canada pushes back every once in a while. And I guess John Chrétien is pointing out that he's pushed back at times. And those who are, you know, connections to Jean Chrétien, pointing out that that Canada ought to push back, and that the Americans would soon get over it.
Yeah, you know, it is so crucial in a sense of it. There was a time when I suppose this is the old Pierre Trudeau team. They came in when it was a very popular idea to develop relations with China. Mm-hmm. They've been beneficial. Mm-hmm. And when this dispute broke open, Brian Mulroney said he thought John Chrétien should help solve it. But he gave an interview to the Globe and Mail yesterday in which he said he's withdrawing that suggestion, mm-hmm. because Chrétien suggested the opposite, which is say, let her go and just forget it. And let's get mm-hmm. back on track. But Mulroney said something I want to get your thoughts about. Mulroney said, really, we belong to the Five Eyes group. He said it, the Globe and Mail. He said, and they do not want Huawei. And we have to go along, because if we don't obey the Five Eyes group, Australia, New Zealand, UK, US, Canada, they may not let us be a member of the Five Eyes. And the Five Eyes is it's almost a white supremacist group. It's white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Anglo-American gang. This is the old gang. You can go back to the 1800s. There they are. And here's me telling the world, hey, we got to go with Five Eyes. I mean, this is embarrassing, isn't it? It should be.
It is. It raises the question, why do we need to belong to the Five Eyes? Mm-hmm. And what's our role in the Five Eyes? And what do we contribute? You're right. It's part of an imperialist group in which the United States is at the head of it, and all the other countries are simply subordinate parts of it.
It's a spy organization, right? I mean, my understanding is that they share and they do little dirty tricks. For example, if Canadians want to spy on a Canadian, which would be illegal, they tell Australians there's a guy they're interested in Canada. The Australians spy on him, and then they share that information.
Yeah, and so this is important to point out, because we had Trudeau talking about how they cannot intervene to release Meng because Canada respects the rule of law, and yet the Five Eyes is simply a mechanism for circumventing the rule of law. I mean, on so many occasions. I mean, the United States, Canada, all of these countries, they have no respect for the rule of law. It's really incredible chutzpah that they can say that my hands are tied. You know, we have to follow the law.
Well, also, that's right. And Mulroney said we are a civilized country, meaning the Five Eyes, that we are a group, and we have the same values. But my goodness, the head of the group has something called Abu Ghraib.
Yes.
A place called Guantanamo.
Yes.
Something called extraordinary extradition, which is to say it could take Stephen Gallens from Ottawa and put him somewhere in Latvia and ask him questions.
Yes, exactly. And it reminds me of Obama once saying, well, we tortured a few folks to death.
folks.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's quite extraordinary, a situation. And we would benefit, wouldn't we, if we could get just say, well, let's just put Five Eyes on the table. Let's just say Mulroney has said that we need to go with Five Eyes. If you're not with Five Eyes, you're with the world, the ones who aren't Five Eyes and are not allowed to join. It's an exclusive club. Sarkozy, according to the history books, wanted to join. And they said, no, you speak French. Yeah. You know, confuse all of our advanced thinkers because none of them speak French.
Well, this reminds me of the Australians have announced that they're going to be building up their military as part of the Five Eyes, or and building up their espionage capabilities, all aimed at China, to which the Chinese, or at least Global Times, a Chinese newspaper, had referred to Australia, I thought, fittingly as the big kangaroo that is an American dog. Yeah. And so Canada can fill the same role, perhaps not as a kangaroo, the big beaver that mm-hmm. U.S. attack dog. Mm-hmm. Certainly,
Go ahead.
Certainly an integral part of U.S. imperialism and the U.S. project of dominating and exploiting the rest of the world. Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you, I guess we'd be in here, and we're experiencing a global pandemic, and the World Health Organization put out all the necessary information for countries of the world to be acquainted with what the danger was or is. And yet, and that came out in January when it was first discovered in Wuhan. Actually, as far as I know, the discovery and the sharing of all information from the Chinese government to the World Health and to everybody else was actually rather rapid.
Yes.
And now months have gone by, it's 6 months later, and the United States has, 128,000 dead. I think it's approaching 2 million cases. And so Canadian newspapers and television and radio talk about the Chinese messed up. I don't get the impression the Chinese people believe that. The evidence seems to be that they're rather impressed at what happened. So you have the greatest capitalist power on earth with 128,000 dead and counting, and you have a country of 1.4 billion, and they had fewer than 90,000 cases. It's because it's under control, and that's what they'd have, 90,000, with, I think, about 5,000 dead. So it's kind of raw evidence, isn't it, of a different social system?
Yes, it is. In regard to the scapegoating, I mean, even the scapegoating of China, and not only of China, but there's been scapegoating of Chinese as well. Even if it was the case that there was some delay or concealment in China, it's still the case that the White House knew about this early on and has done really nothing. Well, done something, but certainly not that much. And when we look at the Chinese numbers versus the American numbers, they're not even in the same ballpark. It's quite astonishing, the difference. And in terms of different systems, yeah, I mean, this is kind of very interesting. I was reading, I think it was the New York Times, and the New York Times is doing a survey of the coronavirus throughout Latin America, and saying the coronavirus, or Latin America, is now the epicenter of the crisis. And in many of these countries, or most of the countries, The decision has been made that you can't lock down because most people are living in or trying to get by in an informal economy. In other words, they don't have much of an economy. And that's another interesting thing. Latin America has been dominated by the United States for how long? And the U.S. has always made the argument that if you do what we say, you'll have prosperity. Well, there's no prosperity in Latin America. And because there's no prosperity, because they can't provide jobs and a decent living for these people, the decision was made, well, they have a choice. They can either starve to death with a lockdown, or we lift the lockdown and they can get sick. But anyway, the point of all this is, in the midst of all of this discussion about Latin America, suddenly the New York Times says, but you know what? Not all is dire in the region. Cuba is one exception. Why would that be? Of course, they don't go on to explore it except to kind of demonize it and say, well, in Cuba, they have this military-style healthcare intervention.
Draconian.
Yes.
Authoritarian.
But in those countries, I mean, Cuba, Vietnam, in China, all of these countries are doing precisely what everyone knows needs to be done and which the WHO keeps emphasizing. And even Anthony Fauci in the United States acknowledges, which is the cornerstone is to find, isolate, test, and care for every case, and to trace and to quarantine, and also mask wearing. So thinking about this, you know, this is something that there are some people have said, you know, the United States knows how to wage war. It doesn't know how to wage war against the virus. But I think it's the case that the United States does know how to fight viruses, just that it won't do it.
Yeah.
Doesn't care to do it, even though viruses kill more Americans sometimes than many wars have.
Yeah. It's a capitalist, it's a class system, and in a class system, you know, what you said about, well, you're going to have to get disease and die in order to make the system go, that's pretty much the same when you want a job.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take the, it's dangerous in here, I'm going to take the first 10 guys, the rest of you go home. And that's not a very nice choice.
but no.
It's amazing how ideological they are, that they almost have a consensus, certainly amongst the rulers, Democrat, Republican. This is how we're going to do it. Somebody's going to die.
Yeah. And you know, I was reading Patrick Coburn, the veteran foreign affairs correspondent, and he was trying to make this argument that all of this is just incompetence. The U.S. and British governments are incompetent to bring, they can't bring the pandemic to heel. But then look at what they did in Libya, he said. In Libya, they just created a huge mess and chaos because they're just completely inept. And I thought he misses the point. They're inept if you assume certain things erroneously about what they're trying to accomplish. And I think that Coburn does. What he doesn't recognizes what the real goals were. And when you look at that, maybe they're not so incompetent. So, I mean, the goal in Libya was to overthrow the economic nationalism, and that was achieved. Likewise, he misunderstands the goal, I think, of British and U.S. governments in the pandemic, which isn't to safeguard public health, but to minimize disruption to the tranquil digestion of profits. Which is why in the United States and Britain, they haven't actually executed on what they know about how to limit the spread of the disease and how to deal with the pandemic. Yeah. Could be done. They just don't do it.
Yeah. We're speaking to Stephen Gallens. He's the author of Patriots, Traitors, and Empires. The Story of Korea's Struggle for Freedom, Baraka Books. And Stephen, it's gallons.wordpress.com, is it not?
Yes, I believe.
Well, you see, I'm rusty. I haven't been doing interviews. I'm really delighted we could talk to you. And I guess I would ask you, maybe on the last note, just to wind again on Korea, do you anticipate, it's also election season, do you actually think they're going to do anything before November, or the, is this thing over with? Are we going to, is the U.S. going to go back into its, this mode? Well, I actually should mention a specific thing. They were sending balloons with propaganda across the border, which it, that's one of the oldest, dirtiest insults that the South has been playing. And I thought that was over with. So is that where we are? The new liberal who was in South Korea, he's not working out? Your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, well, that was the reason why this office was blown up. I mean, when Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, and Kim Jong-un met in April of 2018, they said, okay, look, what we're going to do is we're no longer going to provoke each other. Well, they had... what they were going to do is they said we'd completely cease all hostile acts against each other.
That's exactly.
We'd stop broadcasting propaganda. That was an explicit part of the so-called Panmunjom agreement. And we'd also embark on programs of mutual disarmament. So the North Koreans said, okay, great, but look what you're doing. You're buying these advanced F-35A jet fighters from the United States. That isn't embarking on a mutual program of disarmament. You are allowing U.S. pilots to fly strategic bombers through Korean airspace. And the United States loves to do that. They fly these strategic bombers toward the North Korean border. Just before they arrive at the border, they veer off. Deliberately done to intimidate and rattle the North Koreans. They say... continue to participate in these war games with the United States, even though you said that you would no longer engage in hostile acts. And despite explicitly committing to end the distribution of propaganda leaflets, you released these propaganda leaflets across the border 10 times in 2009 and 3 times in the first 6 months of 2020. So on the basis of that, we don't believe that you're really interested in peace and refraining from engaging in hostile and provocative acts. Yeah. And that's why they blew up this joint liaison office. The way it's presented in the West is those North Koreans are really belligerent, aren't they? And then they present the South Koreans as saying, you know, we're really interested in peace, and I hope the North Koreans continue to talk to us.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, that's a great summary. We do appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you very much. It was nice to talk to you.
The sound of your city. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.